Leading Ideas Talks is brought to you by the Lewis Center for Church Leadership of Wesley Theological Seminary in Washington, D.C. Subscribe free to our weekly newsletter, Leading Ideas, at churchleadership.com/leading ideas. Leading Ideas Talks has been brought to you by More Church Leaders, Stronger Church Leaders. This video toolkit teaches you strategies to identify and support new leaders and build and maintain effective ministry teams. More Church Leaders, Stronger Church Leaders is available on download and DVD at churchleadership.com/shop. How can you activate the gifts of others and multiply the impact of your ministry? In this episode, we speak with Dave Ferguson about becoming a hero maker by focusing on making those around you great leaders.
I'm Ann Michael, Associate Director of the Lewis Center for Church Leadership of Wesley Theological Seminary, and I'm pleased to be the host of this episode of Leading Ideas Talks. I'm visiting today with Dave Ferguson, who's the lead pastor of Chicago's Community Christian Church, and he is co-author with Warren Bird of the book Hero Maker: Five Essential Practices for Leaders to Multiply Leaders. So I'm so excited to have the opportunity to talk with you today, Dave, about this important subject.
Thanks for having me, Ann.
Yeah. So before we get into the specifics of what it means to be a hero maker, I want to begin with a more general question. I've been working in leadership studies for a long time, and I'm aware of a paradox, and it's this: that almost every church leader that I talk to tells me how urgent the need is in their church for there to be more new leaders and better energized leaders. But yet at the same time, my sense is that there's very little attention given to the subject of leadership development. I think that's beginning to change, and your book obviously is a step in that direction. But I wondered if you could help me think about why it is that the church has so often ignored this need of leadership development, or when they do it in ineffective ways, at least in my opinion.
No, I would agree, unfortunately, with probably your observation, Anne. I think maybe we've made leadership development more complicated and more of a mystery than it actually is. Because I think if pastors and other church leaders begin to understand that really leadership development is just another expression of discipleship, that what you're doing is you're growing but multiplying probably someone who has a leadership gift or at least some influence. I think if they began to see it as a simpler version of that, I think it wouldn't seem so daunting, so intimidating, or so like, oh my gosh, that's another thing I have to do. No, it's actually the primary thing you have to do, except it's just at a leadership level.
Yeah, I think that's helpful because I often talk in my work about the need to institute more organic approaches to leadership development, as opposed to, I think, so many ways the church has come at it in the past have been sort of very rigid and institutionalized, but not as effective.
Oh, I concur 100%. I mean, that's... And we'll probably get there in our conversation, but that's why I've been such a big advocate of apprenticeship. And I would say apprenticeship, and that the idea around apprenticeship not only works, let's take a step back again, with discipleship, but it also works with leadership development. And I do think it is a much more kind of organic. And by organic, I'm not saying you do whatever you want, but I'm saying it is a much more relational kind of approach that almost anyone can be involved in once they understand it.
So can you define for our listeners what you mean by a hero maker approach to leadership or discipleship?
Yes, absolutely. I so love this topic. I think that the idea around a hero maker is that the focus is for a particular leader, not just to be a great leader. Okay, because I think mostly people who are leaders, they want to do a good job, they want to serve well, they want to steward their talents in the right directions. But there's a tweak here, and it's really significant, is instead they want to make the leaders around them great. So rather than just trying to be a great leader, you want to make the leaders around you great. I think that's one of the biggest differences.
Yeah, so my colleague Lovett Weems, who's the founding director of our leadership center, often says that a good leader makes heroes of others rather than trying to always be the hero themselves.
Exactly right. Well, or one of my mentors, maybe you knew Bob, Bob Buford. Bob would say this. Yeah, Bob would say, my fruit grows on other people's trees.
Oh, wow.
And I think that's great. In fact, do you have time for an example of kind of a hero maker? Mm-hmm. And this one doesn't really come from the church world. And sometimes when we get examples from other places, I think it helps us kind of, see it in a different light. You don't happen to be a runner, do you?
No, but I mean, I think I'll still understand a running metaphor. So,
okay. Well, there is a probably one of the premier runners, and she just recently retired in the U.S. is a woman by the name of Shalane Flanagan. And Shalane Flanagan won the New York Marathon in 2017. And the reason that was a big deal was because she was the first female American to win it in 40 years. Hmm. And she did it in an unbelievable time. Now, there was an article written about her in the New York Times, and it's fascinating because it says, and I'll just read you a brief clip from this, and it describes her accomplishment. I think it gives us a glimpse of what it means to be a hero maker.
Okay.
Said this, the writer of the New York Times, it says, perhaps Flanagan's bigger accomplishment lies in her nurturing and promoting the rising talent around her. Even bigger than her winning the New York Marathon, okay? Goes on and say, a rare quality in the cutthroat world of elite sports. Every single one of her training partners, all 11 women in total on Team Nike, have made it to the Olympics while training with her.
Wow.
And it goes on, and they call it the Shalane effect. You serve as a rocket booster for the careers of the women who work alongside you while catapulting forward yourself. Now, wouldn't it be cool if they had something called the Ann effect? Because everybody, I mean, think about that. Everybody knows you're up to big stuff, and you want to do great things for God's kingdom. But they also know that anybody gets close to you is going to do great things. And I think when you get that, that's the idea behind a hero maker. It's not just you, but you're trying to make everybody around you better and help them become the best they can be. That's the focus. Well,
yeah, and I think, I think that approach to leadership development is why the Christian movement was able to get off the ground in the first place. I mean, this is how Jesus developed leaders. I mean, he brought a group of other people around him and spent a lot of time in helping them grow and develop. And by the time we get to the book of Acts, we can see the amazing leadership force that Jesus put in place. So I think you've really given a contemporary label to a practice that is as old as the Bible.
One of the great things about, I think, the terminology, the nomenclature of hero maker when you're talking about leadership development, mm-hmm. is that it's a new term. And sometimes when you talk about leadership development, the people in your church or the people that you're working with, they assume they already know what you're talking about. But when you say hero maker, what I've found, and actually I had a friend in Norway who taught me this, that language creates the paradigm, and then the mental paradigm helps create the future. And so when you introduce new language, all of a sudden it gives people a new paradigm, a new way of thinking about it, which then creates a new possibility. So I think going back to even your original insight, how it's not been leadership development has not had a prominent place in a lot of churches. I think by introducing this new terminology, it's like it gives you a second chance for people to like see leadership development differently.
Yeah, it's a new hook to hang your hat on and give you a new lens to think about it, even though it's not really a new approach.
Exactly right. But more mm-hmm. importantly, it gives the people in your church a different way of thinking about it. Because when you start talking about Shalane Flanagan, all of a sudden they're going like, oh, I never thought about that. So I could do that with my students that are in my youth group. I could do that with the my Sunday school teachers, or I could do that with my small group leaders, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
But back to Jesus.
So that's a really helpful point of reference, because I think, some of us who are seminary educated, we're busy giving, biblical names to this stuff or theological categories and not thinking about it in plain everyday terms, which hero maker is. So the first practice that you highlight in your book is multiplication thinking. And you define that as a mindset shift from thinking about ministry happening through our own individual efforts to understanding that ministry happens when we empower other leaders. And I think it's simple to say that, but in fact, I think it's quite hard for most people to really step into that mindset shift. So I wondered why you think it is that it's so challenging for people to approach it that way, and maybe how they can begin to embrace that new mindset.
Yeah, great question. I think part of the reason multiplication thinking, this first practice of a hero maker, is so difficult is because what it requires, I think, for most of us to get to multiplication is it is catalyzed by a big dream. We need to have a big dream to kind of force us and to push us into multiplication thinking. And the reality is that most of us kind of live in the tyranny of the urgent. We're kind of stuck in the what we have to get done right now. I had an experience that I think really illustrates how it pushed, this big dream pushed me into multiplication thinking. I was at a workshop, and I remember the gentleman who was teaching the workshop, and he said, I want you to take your current dream for your church. And I was a church planner, and my dream, okay, just listen to the way I say this, and it's embarrassing. My dream for my church was that I wanted to see it be 1,000 people. I thought, okay, if I had 1,000 people, that would be a really big deal. And then he said, I want you to take your current dream and multiply it by 1,000,000. And so I thought, okay, 1,000 times 1,000,000. That's 1,000,000,000, right?
Right.
and then he said this. He said, now I want you to figure out how can you make that happen. Now, confession here, Ann. As a young church planter, I probably thought, okay, you know what? I could teach well enough that maybe I could attract 1,000 people, or I could organize things well enough that I could get people in small groups and have a church of 1,000 people. But now he said, I want you to dream about 1,000,000,000, right? Mm-hmm. I knew I could never do that. In fact, not only could I not do that, I knew that my church couldn't do that. I knew my denomination couldn't do that. I'd have to help lots of churches. I'd have to work across denominational lines. I mean, it literally, it was kind of like just kind of blew your mind. You're going like, oh, wow, how would I accomplish that? And what happened for me in that moment is it pushed me beyond my own capability and pushed me into multiplication thinking. Because I had to begin thinking like, okay, I'd have to start lots of churches and I'd have to release lots of church planters. I would have to start networks of churches. I'd have to work across my denomination and other denominations. And I think the reason that most of us don't get to multiplication thinking is because we don't have a big dream that pushes us. Yeah. So one of the things I just, rather than 1,000,000, which is audacious, I will challenge leaders. I'll say, I'll tell you, take your current dream instead, whatever it is, and just multiply it by 100.
I'd say 2. Multiply it by 2 even.
But if you do that, all of a sudden, and then you ask the question, now, how would I accomplish that? It puts you in a place where you go, you know what? I know I could not do that on my own. I'm going to have to invest in other people who will also have the value of investing in other people and developing other leaders to do that. And so I challenge leaders. I say, you know what? If you don't have a dream that makes you dependent on God, you need to get a bigger dream.
Yeah, that is such a good point, because I hear two theories of thought on this. I hear people who think like you do, who say, in order to inspire people and get other people motivated and involved, we need to have God-sized visions. And I personally ascribe to that theory. I think that is so true. And I think one of the reasons that your everyday church has had such a hard time engaging people is the things they're asking them to do, frankly, aren't very exciting. They're asking them to sit on a committee or, you know, I mean, someone once said to me, if your church's biggest dream for the next year is, renovating the downstairs men's bathroom, really bold leaders in your orbit don't really care to devote that much time to a project like that. And I agree with that. I think we often under-challenge people, and so they're not really inspired to engage as they might. But on the other hand, I hear a lot of people say, no, you have to start real small. You need to give people small tasks and then let them, you know, if they do well at a small task, then maybe they can do a little bit more. That, you know, a very sort of small and incremental approach to trying to get people involved. I kind of see those as opposite of each other.
You know what? Let me, this will be fun. Let's try this on then. Because what I often do is I will challenge leaders with both those things. I would tell them, dream big but start small.
Yeah.
So dream big. So like for me, one of the values that I have is, even though I have a larger church with lots of different locations across Chicagoland, and I get a chance to lead a global church planning network, I lead a small group on Tuesday nights.
Mm-hmm.
And I try to always have an apprentice leader that I'm developing in that small group. And because that's when we planted our church, you know, 30 years ago, that's where we started. Every one mm-hmm. of us, there were five of us on a team, all of us went and started groups, and we had an apprentice leader, and we started multiplying leaders that way. And that's been the outgrowth of that. And so when I'm talking to young leaders especially, yeah, have the big dream, but start small so that
right.
so the smallest component has this multiplicative effect to it that can create a movement.
Right. And that's the Jesus approach too, right? I mean,
well,
you know,
I hope so.
I know, I am so struck by the fact that, you know, Jesus spent most of the 3 years of his ministry investing in 12 other leaders.
Exactly right.
And yeah, so that leads me to an apprenticeship, which was another aspect of your book that I wanted to lift up. I think you have some interesting things to say about sort of how apprenticeship can happen in simple ways. I mean, you've already described it in terms of a small group setting, but mm-hmm. What are some other ways that an apprenticeship approach to developing others can work in a congregation or other ministry setting?
Sure. I mean, let me chit-chat a little bit on what you said there too. I mean, I co-wrote the book with Warren Bird. And so Warren was able to do, if you know Warren, Warren's a terrific researcher.
Yes, uh-huh.
And Warren actually went through the Gospels, or had somebody go through the Gospels. And they took all the different events in the life of Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
And what they found is that he spent 73% of his time, or 73% of the events, at least in the Bible, were in a small group, kind of in a small group kind of discipleship or apprenticeship context.
Wow.
Oftentimes we think of him as, you know, Sermon on the Mount, feeding the mm-hmm. 5,000, the big
right.
events. And again, so I challenge leaders like, well, what if you took your energies and you put 73% of it into apprenticeship, developing people, developing leaders, and then, which is basically what happens during the week, and then only 27% geared up for the Sunday service, the big event, kind of like Jesus
right.
did.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing of it is too, back to your original question, this idea of apprenticeship works in every experience of church. So for example, if you came to Community Christian Church, you could walk into one of our Kid City areas, and you might see one of our Kid City leaders, and there'd be someone who's shadowing them, who's their apprentice leader. You might walk into our auditorium, and the back of the booth, in the back of the room, there's a booth there that has, you know, all the tech, the audio, video, and all that kind of stuff. And you might see someone who's actually running the iMag and the PowerPoint, but there'll be someone looking over their shoulder. And so that person is literally, okay, being apprenticed to run media. You can do this in the arts. You can do it in kids ministry. You can do it in student ministry. You can do adult ministry. You can do it for church planting. Anything that you're doing, if you can show someone else how to do it, you can apprentice them.
Well, and that's a good example of something that's so natural and organic, just inviting somebody to come alongside and do something with you, as opposed to, you know, some formal process of leadership training or something like that. I mean, the apprentice model is so organic, really.
Well, and that's, I think to your point too, that's what Jesus did. And
right?
in John 3:22, it's this little phrase there. It says, Jesus spent some time with them.
Yeah.
And my understanding is even that little phrase is a Greek word, diatribo, which is a composite of two different words, dia and tribo, which literally means to rub off. And so it's like Jesus said, you know what, for the next 3 years, I'm just going to rub off on these guys.
Yeah, I loved that. I loved that in your book. That taught me something new, and it really gave me something to think about. I sometimes think about the story of the Transfiguration in that way too, about how Jesus took the two disciples up to the mountaintop, and the little words, it is good that we are here. I mean, yes. You know, just being together, you know, the importance yeah. of just him having them with him in that moment. I've always felt that was really a leadership development text, and nobody ever reads it that way. but I think that it is. So another practice that you lift up in the book is you talk about commissioning as a way of affirming people's gifts. And I wondered if you could explain what you mean by that and how you do that in your congregational setting, because I thought that was such a powerful but I think easy thing that a church could adapt into their practice.
Yeah, this has probably been maybe 10 years ago. We just had kind of a conviction again about the priesthood of all believers. And we were teaching from 1 Peter chapter 2, verse 9, where it talks about we're a royal priesthood. And so we were teaching that, and particularly in the Chicago context, and you're in Washington, D.C., so it's probably similar. Most everybody here, if you have a church background, your church memory is probably Catholic. And so I'm teaching them, hey, you know what? The Bible says, no, we're all priests. We're all priests. And you could see them kind of looking at me, and we began to unpack that, what that meant for us to be a royal priesthood. And I said, and as a priest, you have a parish. And your parish is wherever you live or you work or you play, the people you influence. And then we went on and we kind of said, and you know what? And if you feel God's calling you uniquely to reach and help grow up and disciple the people where you live, work, and play, in that which is your parish, we want you to come forward, because we want you to know that you have the full blessing of our church, and we want to commission you, okay, just like it says in the Bible, to go and do that work. And so we had people come forward, and we prayed for them. We anointed them with oils, a sign of blessing. And we had so many people come forward. In fact, I'll tell you what, Anne, it was one of those weird times where I was going like, okay, hold it. This is going too well. It's kind of like there were too many people that came forward. And and we had people say things like, yeah, I think I'm supposed to go and start a Bible study where I work. And wow. So we prayed for them, said, you go. I remember we had one couple that came forward and said, I think we're supposed to go to Haiti. I think God's calling us to Haiti to work in an orphanage. And I knew they had two little kids. And to be honest with you, my cynical side, because I remember I'm going like, you're not going to Haiti. A year later, I was in Haiti with them, and they moved there. And we just had one person after another. And so that's become something that we do on an annual basis now, where we give that challenge. And people maybe who are already serving in ministry roles, but people who are brand new want to do that, we have them come forward, which is a big deal to come forward like that. And we pray for them and say, no, you have the full blessing of our church, and you go. And yeah. we call that a commissioning.
Yeah, I mean, I as I hear you describe it, it seemed simple to me in the book, and it is simple. But on the other hand, it is not a small thing for people to commit themselves in that way. And so, I think that's part of the power of it. That it is so empowering, sort of a permission giving posture.
And I think for those of us who spend a lot of our time on the stage or up front like that, for them to have the opportunity to come up front, it's, you know, which happens, you know, once a year or however often, it's a really holy moment for them, and they take it very seriously.
Yeah, I read something just recently that really caught my attention. I mean, North American Christianity is so event-based. And I mean, we almost take it for granted that our expressions of church are so built around, you know, the Sunday worship event or the weekend worship event, and then whatever other kinds of ancillary programming is connected onto it, that leaders put so much of their attention on making sure that happens the way they think it's supposed to happen, that there's not a lot of space for the kind of work that you're describing in small groups or in interpersonal setting.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think it goes back to what you introduced earlier too. We talked about how Jesus spent so much time with just the 12.
Right.
And I mean, one of the things that we do say at Community Christian Church, the church I lead, is we say, if we only got to have one event in the life of our church, it would be a small group. Because it's in the small group that you get to experience the complete fullness of every experience of the church. Mm-hmm. I mean, I love our, you know, when we get to have the large celebration service, that's great. But the experience of community, the ability to do the one another's, it doesn't happen in that setting.
One of the things I found quite interesting about your book, and it goes back to the point you made earlier about needing big dreams, but you argue that we need a different scoreboard to measure the impact of ministry. So I wanted to ask you to explain sort of what's the problem with the way that we're measuring our ministry impact and what we need to be doing differently.
Yeah, I think the average probably pastor probably has a chronic preoccupation with kind of, okay, how do I grow my church? Which is kind of a good question. But I think what that ends up with the kind of scoreboard we have right now, which is just we kind of count, you know, nickels and noses and bucks and butts or whatever terminology.
Right.
And I think we spend some time in the book too talking about how we ask the wrong questions. And I think the reason we have that scoreboard is because of the question we're asking, which is how can I grow my church? Which is I think a good question. It's just not a great question, and it's certainly not a hero maker question. I think the hero maker question and the great question is how do we, which would be not just me, but we, like me and others, okay, other churches, multiply, not just grow, but how do we multiply God's kingdom? Because I think we get a preoccupation with just what's happening in our church, the one that if you're a pastor or on staff, they're the one that writes the check for your salary or the steeple that you're under, instead of the bigger kingdom. And I think we have to get a kingdom scoreboard. And if we don't get a kingdom scoreboard, we'll never see movement, because we'll just be preoccupied with, you know, that one little square inch on the corner of, you know, Main and Elm.
Yeah. So that actually really leads me to the last question that I want to ask, because I do think that the beauty really of your book and the beauty of your approach is that it's grounded in a much more expansive understanding of church than I think many people in our pews or even, you know, pastors and church leaders typically operate with. I mean, we do tend to have a very parochial view of church and think about it only in terms of, you know, our own buildings and what's under our own roofs. And so I wanted to ask practically, how do you get your people to think bigger about church and the potential of what could be?
I think as particularly if we're talking to the church leaders and if we're talking to church staff and pastors, mm-hmm. I think we have to see part of our role is we are the culture creators. We create the culture. And candidly, if you don't like the culture, if you've been there more than 4 years, it's probably your fault. And I would suggest that if you want to have a culture that helps you in your church, where they don't just see church as the small C, what's happening in my particular local expression of church, but the bigger C church, a couple things come to mind. Is one is I'd encourage you to join a network, or in many of your cases, how do you actually lock arms with people in your denomination, and for something that's bigger than just your church? So like for, I'll just use our church as an example. One of the things that we've recently done is we now are part of a larger network across Chicagoland that has about 35 churches that's committed to planting 25 churches over the next 2 years. And we talk about that regularly at Community Christian. And because the senior leadership has locked arms with those folks, I think that gives them a picture of the bigger C, capital C church, the kingdom of God. And I think it also gets expressed in areas, not just like church planning, which I love, but also in areas like of social justice. I mean, mm-hmm. we're one of the things that one of our church planning partner churches, a friend of mine, Watson Jones at Compassion Baptist on the south side of Chicago, he gave us a call and he said, one of the things we're discovering in the middle of this COVID pandemic is that of all the deaths, 70% of the deaths in Chicago were happening in the African-American communities, and they made up only 29% of the population. And he said, we began to explore that a little further. And what we found is that a lot of the folks that are on the SNAP's food assistance program, while that's great that they're able to get food assistance, they don't bring the food to them. They have to go to the grocery store. And so some of the most vulnerable, the people in the African American community, are making the most trips to the grocery store, they were actually contracting the disease that way. So Watson said, we came up with an idea. We're going to do something called Chicago Delivers, and we're going to make sure that the food gets delivered to them, but it's going to cost some dollars. Would you partner with us in it? And so, you know, we chipped in money and other churches chipped in money. We launched this thing called Chicago Delivers to help kind of, you know, fight against that, lock arms with other churches. And I think when you do those kinds of things together with other churches outside yourself, and then you tell the stories, that's what helps your churches go like, oh, okay. It's not just, you know, the 50 of us in this room or the 500 of us in this room, however big your church is. No, we're a part of the broader kingdom of God across Chicagoland, around the world, that is trying to advance the mission of Jesus.
Yeah, well, thank you for sharing that story. I particularly took note when you talked about the importance of shaping culture. I think that is such an important leadership function, to understand how what a leader does and says, and how you frame things, and how you present ideas, and how you communicate, how all of that helps to shape a culture. I work a lot in stewardship ministry, and I'm convinced that, you know, generosity isn't something that's taught, it's caught, and it just is something that has to become part of your culture. And there are ways that leaders can work that help to shape that. So I really appreciate you mentioning that important leadership role of shaping culture. Dave, this has been a fascinating conversation, and I am really grateful that you've taken the time to talk with me and talk with our listeners today, and I'm also really grateful for this book as a very needed contribution in the area of leadership development. So thanks so much for talking with me today.
No, thanks. Thank you. And you've been a hero maker, because one of the things we talk about hero makers is they build platforms and they let other people stand on them. And so I want to say thank you for letting me stand on your platform. I'm grateful for that.
On the next Leading Ideas Talks, we speak with Debbie Nixon about the art of hospitality and why hospitality is a critical part of vital ministry.
One of the things that I always tell people is that I believe that radical hospitality is that hospitality that delights people, that it surprises them. They feel noticed because they're experiencing something that they hadn't anticipated. And because of that, then for those of us in a ministry, it allows us to have a greater opportunity then for them to get to know the love of Jesus Christ and for us to share the gospel with them.
Thank you for joining us. And don't forget to subscribe free to our weekly newsletter, Leading Ideas, at churchleadership.com/leadingideas.